Good evening. It is 5 p.m. and this is Today in YGK on CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. Today in YGK is brought to you by CFRC's news collective, Christina Laurie, Jesse Bell, and Ellie Sturton. CFRC's news programming is made possible by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Christina Laurie, and here are your local news headlines. In a cat carrier, an animal that looks like a cross between a squirrel and a raccoon, but unlike anything native to Canada, looks grumpy. He certainly sounds grumpy, and rightfully so. He's over 3,000 kilometers away from home, and he didn't exactly buy a ticket. Sandy Pines Wildlife Center in Napanee recently welcomed an unexpected guest last month, whose journey is still unfolding. The story began after receiving a call from a manufacturer reporting a strange animal found in a shipping container. Sue Meach, director of Sandy Pines, recounts the unusual call they received on the evening of June 16th.
We got a call from some people in Belleville that worked at an auto parts store. They said that they had a Mexican raccoon in a bin, and it had been there for a day, and they put some water in, but they didn't know what to do with it.
Sandy Pines volunteer Greg Oosting was sent to investigate the next day. What he found was certainly not a raccoon, but needed help nonetheless.
I said, be prepared for what you see. I'm really not sure what this is, but we need to help the animal. Anyway, he got there and he said, well, this isn't a raccoon, but I'm going to catch it anyway. And it's going to die if it stays in here. So he was able to trap it. And then it was brought into us by a volunteer.
Once at the center, staff quickly identified the visitor as a caco mussel, a small nocturnal mammal native to Central America, characterized by its dark green tail.
It's a very small mammal. It only weighs less than a kilogram. So it's very small, about half the size of a cat, maybe a six-month-old kitten. And it has a long tail with beautiful gray and white stripes, or black and white stripes, actually, all the way up. At first, we were told it was a lemur, but when we did our homework and started looking it up online, we realized that it couldn't be a lemur because lemurs come from Africa. So we did a bit of research and discovered that there was a similar species in South America or Central America, and it was commonly known as a ringtail, but the technical name is a caco mussel. So it arrived, and at least we knew what we were getting, and we were prepared somewhere for him. They like trees to climb, so we had a barn stall set up with trees in it, branches in it that have been donated by very generous people, and trim their trees and bring branches in for our animals. And we set up a nice little den in there for him, and in he went. Apparently, the company in Belleville makes headlights for vehicles, and they pack up the headlights in sea cans and sends them to Mexico. Mexico then sends back the empty sea can, and somehow this little guy, I can see how he's so small, if he'd gotten into the corner of a really big sea can in the dark, when you looked in, you wouldn't spot him right away.
While the stowaway was frightened, it was coping well under the unusual circumstances. The question now was how to return it home, or at the very least, to a safe environment.
So then it was the dilemma of what is the legal process for handling a situation like this. We did have this happen once with a bird. We had an albatross here many years ago that was not indigenous to Canada. But that was with Canadian Wildlife Services that do the avian species. So I reached out to the Ministry of Natural Resources, and who I'm a custodian. I have a license under their authority. And they said, well, it wasn't their department, called the Canadian Food Inspection Agency. They deal with animals crossing the border. apparently, whether they're exotics or food animals that are coming in. Anyway, they laughed when I called them and said, well, it's funny that you should call us because we got a call from Belleville and they said to bring the animal to you and call you. So I was going round in circles here.
Meets began reaching out for guidance and suggestions. Eventually, she connected with Lee Parker, zoo director at Little Rays Nature Center, an exotic animal rescue located in Ottawa.
But I have a friend who's a vet in Ottawa, and she had told me that she works with exotics. So I explained to her that we had this caca missile, and we were quite happy to give him temporary accommodation, but obviously he needed something more than we could give him, maybe even try to get him back to Mexico. Anyway, she contacted me back and said, Little Rays has a nature center in Ottawa, and she's the veterinarian in charge there, and she checks all the animals as a volunteer. And she thought that would be the best place for him while we figured out a solution for this little guy. So I contacted Lee at the nature center, and he said that this was an unusual case, and they usually seem to get calls about reptiles and snakes, but he would be very happy to help. So he even said that they would come and pick up the animal, which was a great help because this is such a busy time for us. Anyway, he came and we had him all packed up, his bags packed and everything, and off he went.
While reptiles or amphibians sometimes slip into Canada, this case involving a mammal is a less common occurrence, according to Parker.
So with mammals in Canada, I mean, I've been in Canada for 17 years, going on 18 years, and we often get smaller animals like reptiles and amphibians come through, and they often come through either in fruit or flowers and things like that, which is a little bit, I mean, it's not, you don't get it every month or so on, but I mean, we do hear it, and it's often probably a lot of them that don't even survive, because they often put chillers on the flowers or the fruit and stuff, and food goes into cold storage and things like that, and a lot of these animals probably won't survive. But for mammals, in the time that I've been at Little Rays, this is our first one that I'd heard of coming through like this, but I'm sure it's not the only case of it.
The Caco missile was transferred to Little Rays Nature Center just before the long weekend. Now safely housed at Little Rays, work is being done to determine its origin and what next steps can be taken.
So really the process that we have when something like this comes in, when I got the call from Susan, I mean, Susan does a lot of rescue for native species. And when you have something that's exotic coming in or from another country, you have to be cautious about cross-contamination, especially if you're having animals going back into the wild. So she reached out to me saying, would the Little Rays be able to take this animal on? So that it had a place to go, and then we could either try and figure out a way to get it back to where it came from, or if not that, and it couldn't leave Canada, then where would we be able to find a forever home for this animal should it need to be there? So the steps that have happened right now is that I've gone through the CFIA, which is Canadian Food Inspection Agency. They deal with balls as well as food and things like into Canada. And I was on a call with them three times yesterday, and they obviously don't get this either. So they are working through this currently with me to find out what the best option is and what the steps going forward is with this animal. Since then, we have reached out to a facility that is willing to take it should the CFIA deem that fit for the animal. But at this point in time, it is in our quarantine. We are maintaining him. He's eating. He's a wild animal, so he's not used to people. So we're keeping him under as little stress as possible. We're not overactive in the habitat or anything like that. We go in, we do our routine maintenance of cleaning, feeding, and water changing and stuff like that, monitoring, make sure he's okay. And then once we hear back from the CFIA, we can then proceed with steps for any further veterinary care, whether he needs to have rabies vaccinations, a body checkup, make sure everything's where it needs to be, maybe make sure there's no other illnesses or maybe some blood work and things like that before he actually gets moved on to his forever home. If he ends up finding out where he came from. And that's what the CFA are trying to do, to see exactly where this container came from in the United States, Mexico area. That's where these guys are found, because some of these animals in certain areas are critically endangered. So obviously, if this is an animal in that situation, we would rather get this animal back to where he came from. And that's what we're working on currently.
While Sandy Pines will be getting back to business as usual, mostly with native species, they remain committed to helping in any way they can with the resolution, whether that means a return to the wild or a safe new home.
Well, they said they had a nice big area for him with some trees in it, so he would be safe in there until they could figure out something. Some department of the government is going to have to be involved. And if he is being sent anywhere, we will have to get permits and jump through a lot of hoops. But we'll do our best for this little guy. But at least I know he's in a safe place and he's under veterinary care.
This has been Christina Laurie with CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative.
This is Jesse Bell from the CFRC Sports Desk, and today we're going to be discussing the improbable, unlikely rise of the Toronto Blue Jays from divisional bottom feeder to legitimate AL East leading contender. After a slow spring start that saw the Blue Jays drop 4- and 5- game losing streaks, the Jays have started to rise to contention in the competitive AL East. Offensively, the Jays have received key contributions from some of their usual suspects, namely Bo Bichette and Vladimir Guerrero Jr., but 2025 has also marked a resurgence of center fielder George Springer, who leads the team in home runs, RBIs, and on-base percentage. They've also received key contributions from the likes of Alejandro Kirk, who leads the team with a .304 batting average, and infield utility player, although technically he is listed as a third baseman, Ernie Clement, who has come out of obscurity to put up 2.5 WAR wins above replacement. He's not much of an offensive threat, but he is a tremendous infield player and a key part of this Jays defense. Jose Barrios leads all starters in innings pitched and ERA, whereas Chris Bassitt leads the team in strikeouts with 102, but it's largely been the bullpen that has been the strong suit for this Jays pitching staff. Only time will tell if Toronto can hold on to this narrow division lead that they gained over the weekend, let alone make a playoff push, but it's nice to see a level of enthusiasm and excitement surrounding this team that we haven't seen since the heady days of 2021 and that infuriating 2022 wildcard loss. Regardless of how the season finishes, there can be no doubt that this iteration of the Toronto Blue Jays exceeded what were pretty low expectations. Many, myself included, figured this would be a rebuilding year of sorts. But with the resurgence of George Springer and the emergence of Ernie Clement, Toronto may be able to recapture that postseason magic we saw about 10 years prior. This is your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. We're looking at a rainy start to the week for Monday, July 7th, with a 75% chance of precipitation in the morning, becoming humid and cloudy into the afternoon with a daytime high of 24 degrees. Tuesday, July 8th, we're going to see a daytime high of 25 with mostly sunny conditions, a very small 25% chance of precipitation at times, but it should be a beautiful day. Wednesday, July 9th. Warmest day of the week. We've got a daytime high of 27 with high humidity and sunny conditions projected here in the city of Kingston. Thursday, July 10th, daytime high of 24 degrees, a 90% chance of precipitation. It's going to be warm and humid here in the city of Kingston. Friday, July 11th, daytime high of 25, feeling closer to 31 thanks to the high humidity. Saturday, July 12th, a high of 25. It's going to be a beautiful sunny day. Perfect start to your weekend. Sunday, July 13th, daytime high of 25, cloudy all day with some light cloud coverage into the afternoon. And then starting off next week, Monday, July 14th, 27 degrees, high UV index, lots of sun in the forecast. Here is your City of Kingston traffic report for the week. The LaSalle Causeway will be closed on the following dates, July 6th, 13th, 20th, and 27th, August 3rd, 10th, 17th, 24th, and 31st, and September 7th. All of these days, it will be closed from 6 a.m. to 10 p.m. Shifting now to the fall, some select locations when the LaSalle Causeway will also be closed from 6 a.m. to 8 p.m. September 21st, October 5th, 14th, and 19th, and November 2nd and 16th. Here are your road closures for the week. Albert Street, Princess to Mac is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging at 484 Albert Street. Aberdeen Street, William 2 Johnson is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging. Berry Street, Queen to Colborne is closed for construction-related activity at 283 Queen Street. Carlton Street, Alfred to Guy is closed June 30th to August 8th for a gas main installation. Earl Street, Collingwood to Toronto is closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. Guy Street, Carlton 2 Division is also closed June 30th to August 8th for gas main installation. Ontario Street, Brock to Clarence is closed beginning July 10th at 12:01 a.m. until July 14th at 7 a.m. for Buskers Rendezvous. And Johnson Street at Victoria is closed beginning July 9th at 6:30 a.m. until July 10th at 6:30 p.m. for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. Here are some other delays to be aware of. Accommodation Road, 6th Concession to White Church, expect delays while the contractor is completing work on the annual surface treatment contract. Abbeydon Road, Middle to Highway 2, expect delays while the contractor is completing work on the annual surface treatment contract. Bay Ridge Drive, Milford to Henderson, expect delays for the construction of new active transportation infrastructure. Catterockway Woods Drive, Centennial to Gardeners, expect delays for the construction of a new multi-use pathway. Collins Bay Road, Woodbine to Princess, expect delays while a contractor completes landscaping work on Collins Bay Road. Front Road, Sand Bay to Country Club, expect delays for the installation of sanitary and water main for Utilities Kingston. Traffic is down to one lane in each direction. Gardner's Road at Centennial and Creekford, expect delays while a contractor completes intersection widening, traffic signal upgrades, and cycling and pedestrian improvements. Garrett Road, 6th Concession to Sandhill, expect delays while a contractor is completing work on the annual surface treatment contract. Highway 2 to Abbeydon and St. Lawrence, expect delays to complete enhanced flood protection of Abbeydon Road, Highway 2, and St. Lawrence Avenue. Highway 15, Kingston Mills to Middle, expect delays for a contractor to complete work on the Highway 15 CNR overhead structure. Montreal Street at John Counter, expect delays for upgrades to the intersection, including new lighting, traffic signals, lanes, paving, and signage to improve safety and efficiency for all road users. Victoria Street and Earl Street, expect delays while a contractor mobilizes to site to start work on the second phase of reconstruction of sewer, water main, sidewalks, and road. And White Church Road, 6th Concession to Woodburn, expect delays while the contractor is completing work on the annual surface treatment contract.
Hi folks, I'm CFRC's Ellie Sturton, and coming up, we'll take a look at some great live music happening around town this week. On Monday, Nolan Hubbard kicks off his Monday musical residency at the Cove Inn from 5 to 8 p.m. Expect breathy indie rock and soulful folk pop. Later, head to Confederation Park at 7 p.m. to catch Kentucky Live on Houseboat. He's doing a floating concert on the Rideau Canal where he'll perform his debut album, Second Chance Music. On Tuesday, Kentucky docks at Sealy's Bay Harbor for another Houseboat concert at 7 p.m. And at Time Out Bar and Bistro, Paula Wood and Laura Richardson play from 6 to 8 p.m. Expect rich harmonies, folk, and soulful indie sounds. On Wednesday, catch Kentucky at the Opinicon at 6 p.m. for another floating show. And Swingin' Summer continues in Springer Market Square from 7 to 8 p.m. with the Michael K. Myers Quintet. Expect romantic, big band era jazz in a free outdoor setting. And over at the Creekside Bar and Grill, Christopher Jackson brings folk and roots from 6 to 8 p.m. On Thursday, Jeff Miller plays classic rock covers from 6 to 8 p.m. on the Helm Dockside Patio. That one's 19 plus and free. free. Wizards of Osgood and Wedding perform at Hotel Wolf Island from 8:30 to 11 p.m. Expect psych rock and indie hip-hop. DJ Fresh Pay hosts music trivia at Spearhead Brewery from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. And if you're in the mood for some pop-punk nostalgia, Drink 182 hits the Toucan from 9:30 p.m. to 1 a.m. On Friday, folks can see Riley Merrigan play country at Time Out Bar and Bistro at 3 p.m., followed by Tim Campbell with Blues Originals from 6 to 8 p.m. The Broom Factory is hosting an all-ages indie showcase with Friday's Child and the Lost Congregation, Lake Porter, and Bad Fortune from 7:30 to 10 p.m., and tickets are $20. Over at Next Church, Walks of Life Open Mic runs from 7:30 to 9 p.m. with music, poetry, and comedy. And at 7:30 p.m., Tina, the ultimate tribute to the Queen of Rock and Roll, hits the Grand Theater starring Caroline Burrell. Tickets range from $39 to $65. On Saturday, Johnny Iguana and the Claudettes bring Garage Blues Cabaret to the RCHA from 8 to 11 p.m., with tickets going for $40. See the Amanda Keeley Trio play indie folk at the Cove Inn from 5 to 8 p.m. by donation. Or Doug Vanderhorden performing rock and indie at Juniper Cafe from 4 to 6 p.m. At 7:30 p.m., Alan Doyle plays the Drill Hall at Base 31, and tickets for that show start at $69. Folks can catch Edgar Bro's Dreamy Acoustic Folk at Hotel Wolf Island from 8:30 to 10:20 p.m. Or see the Retrofits debut at K&R Sports Bar from 8 to 11 p.m. with classics and modern rock. Over at Spearhead Brewery, Ethan Crosby plays jazz and soul from 2 to 5 p.m., followed by Neil Carter from 7 to 10 p.m. with hits you'll know and love. Also on Saturday, the Waterside Summer Series presents Cameron Crosman and Megan Malatz at St. Paul's Church at 3:15 p.m. with cello and piano. Tickets are $45 or $22.50 for youth. And don't miss the Vibrant Voices Song Circle from 1 to 3 p.m. at the Central Library. It's free, all ages, and open to all 2SLGBTQIA+ voices. Finally, see Fast Forward to Friday perform at the Legion Branch 560 from 8 to midnight with timeless rock and good vibes. On Sunday, Jazz Brunch returns to the Black Dog Tavern from 11:30 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. with the Black Dog All-Stars and vocalist Chantal Thompson. Finkel's Shore Park hosts Live Music Sundays from 2 to 5 p.m. featuring Abby Stewart, Whiskey Smoke, and the Garvin Brothers. And over at Musiki Cafe, Savannah Shea plays folk and indie from 2 to 4 p.m. Then from 4 to 7 p.m. at Hotel Wolf Island, catch jazz favorites Standards at 7. And later that night, experimental folk duo C. Jones and Mike Gangloff play from 8:30 to 11 p.m. also at Hotel Wolf Island. Have a local concert you would like covered on CFRC's website and our news programming? Contact us today via cfrc.ca. Now coming up, we'll look at some great community events running in Kingston and the area this week. On Monday, the Jazz Society Jam is on at the RCHA from 4:30 to 6:30 p.m. with doors at 4. It's Kingston's premier open jazz jam for just a $5 cover at the door. On Tuesday, put on your dancing shoes for Salsa in the Square. Things get started in Springer Market Square at 6:30 p.m. with a beginner-friendly Latin dance lesson. From 8 p.m. onward, the floor opens for partner and group dancing to salsa, bachata, merengue, and reggaeton. It's free and open to all ages. On Wednesday, head to Springer Market Square from 6 to 8 p.m. for games in the square. Play giant-sized versions of Snakes and Ladders, Connect Four, and Cornhole, or bring your own favorite board game to share. It's a relaxed, family-friendly evening for all ages. On Thursday, start your morning with Stories in the Square at 10:30 a.m. in the City Hall Amphitheater. The Kingston Frontenac Public Library hosts songs and stories for kids of all ages. If the weather's rough, it moves inside to the Central Branch. And the Kingston Buskers Rendezvous officially kicks off Thursday with street corner shows from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m., Busker Play for the kids from 11 to 1 in Confederation Park, and big performances running from 1 to 11 p.m. in Springer Market Square. Thursday evening, there's Life Drawing at Art Noise from 6 to 8 p.m. It's a $10 drop-in with a live model and a relaxed atmosphere. Doors open at 5:30. On Friday, the Busker's Rendezvous continues with more performances from 1 to 11 p.m. and family fun at Busker Play from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Then at 7 p.m., Spearhead Brewery hosts hosts take it off, the drag and burlesque show. Rowena Way returns with Do Lily, James and the Giant Pasty, and Tiffany Morgan. It's 19 plus with tickets at $22.60 in advance or $25 at the door. And starting at 9 p.m., Buskers After Dark takes over Springer Market Square, hosted by Seven Fritz with beats by DJ Trueways. This 19 plus show blends street art with dance floor energy and has a licensed bar from Daft Brewing. On Saturday, the Buskers Rendezvous continues downtown with Busker performances, street corner acts, and the Busker Play Zone. And the opening of the Artisan Market in Confederation Park from 10 to 6 p.m. Over at Hotel Wolf Island, catch a free screening of Foot by Kayak at 4:30 p.m. This local documentary by Laura and Liam Douglas features music from Teilhard Frost and the Gertrudes and includes a post-film Q&A. And on Sunday, start your morning with Yoga in the Park from 10 to 11 a.m. at Battery Park. It's a free all-levels session by the water. It's also the final day of the Buskers Rendezvous, running from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. with street shows, performances, and again, the Artisan Market from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. And finally, don't miss the coffee party with DJ Trueways from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. on Sydenham Street. For just $15, you'll get unlimited coffee and pastries from downtown cafes, plus a morning dance party soundtracked by Trueways himself. Wristbands are limited to 250 people, so don't wait. Have a local event you would like covered on CFRC's website and our news programming? Contact us today via cfrc.ca.
Thank you for tuning in to CFRC's local news programming. To revisit episodes of Today in YGK and hear more from some of our guests, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Today in YGK is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear, 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
What'll I Wear offers the best in vintage, funky, one-of-a-kind treasures, clothing, accessories, and a fabulous selection of jewels, vintage and new. Find the cutest purse, the most dashing of hats and sunglasses, everything to complete your individual look. What'll I Wear has it all. They can dress you from top to bottom. Find your new fashion fave at What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street in Kingston. Visit their new location and follow them on Facebook to keep up to date with what's in store at What'll I Wear. Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office, we're pleased to present a new single from Kingston rocker Rowan Picard, released with her band Rogue Rising. If This Is the End is an upbeat breakup anthem that explores the bittersweet feelings of first love with cool guitar riffs and a catchy chorus that will make you want to sing along. Want to be highlighted next time? Complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via visit kingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream If This Is the End by Rogue Rising on your favorite platforms and enjoy it with us here now on CFRC 101.9 FM.
Yeah.
Good day. You're listening to Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoph, and this is edition 273. And on the broadcast this week, I'm going to be speaking to an important Indigenous photographer, Martin Loft. Martin has long done a multitude of different artistic practices, from photography, but also print work. Martin has worked in the cultural center of Ganasatagi, giving artistic courses to Indigenous community members, but also has exhibited photographs, both focused on Indigenous experiences locally and globally. Martin is also a street photographer and does a lot of documentation around frontline street experiences, as Martin has also worked at community centers connected to the network of Native Friendship Centers. In general, Martin's work is very important, really inspiring Indigenous photographer working today. And so I wanted to share a spotlight on his recent projects. And so here is our conversation. I'm sitting with Martin Loft, Indigenous photographer who has spoken on this program before and is always up to all sorts of awesome activities. I got a list before this conversation of everything you're working on, and it's looking great. And so I'd love to get into some of these details, but first, I think it might be interesting to sort of start off. We're in spring, so that's cool. A lot of spring sort of like themes are around rebirth and rejuvenation and sort of the cycles around that. In some ways, these last few years have seen rejuvenation and resurgence of Indigenous cultural expression. But also there's huge challenges that remain, both around support for Indigenous artists, but also autonomous Indigenous arts institutions. I know you always have a lot to share about those types of ideas. So maybe we could just first start by a brief introduction and then sort of your sense of where things are at around those broad points.
Yeah, all great. Well, thanks for having me on there, Stefan. It's always a pleasure to talk with you. I know you're a great supporter of Indigenous issues and arts and culture and all the things that are connected to it. My name again is Martin Aguirre-Noru Loft. I'm born and raised Kahnawake. I worked at our cultural center in the community for 30 years involved. I had my hand in a number of little baskets, things going on. And one of them, when you walked in, I was listening to our all Ganyakeha radio show. Nice to be intimately involved in the production of that show and our annual all-day events and so on that we used to have in that program. It's always good. I'm a student of the language. I studied the language. I did the immersion, and unfortunately, I'm not a fluent speaker, but I listen and like learning any language. It's kind of like I can pick up maybe 25% to 30% of the conversation, and in between, I can kind of like decipher what's being said. So it's always very interesting, but I can passively understand more than I can speak. For sure, spring is a very important time for our people. Of course, Mother Earth continues to do her cycle, and it's spring and the trees are the sap is running. Wata is our name for the tree, and a tree is what they say is the leader of the trees. We have we give thanks to all creation, from the tiniest insects to the stars and the cosmos and our grandmother, the moon, our father, our brother, the sun. But in between, we have to give thanks to all those things, the grasses, the seeds, and for sure, maple is coming up. And I know that maple in Quebec, you hear about the Cabanasuk and you hear about all these things, and you rarely hear about the origins of some of these things. Mm-hmm. Occasionally you do, but I'm saying that most people, I'm sure, who go to these things are oblivious that, come springtime, come the running of the sap, the native people in this part of the Northeast North America are giving thanks and greetings things and burning tobacco at sunrise and thanking the trees for all of the things that they give us, for our housing, for our furniture, for warmth, and for the sap that runs and the sugar that is made afterwards. It's very important. We are people who live traditionally by the cycles of the environment, and the cycle of ceremonies is intimately involved with nature and with the natural world. Global warming and issues to do with that, you know, are starting to change a little bit. You know, people are beginning to look at collecting seeds, heirloom seeds, seeds mm-hmm. that are important mm-hmm. to our culture. And, you know, unfortunately, you know, these things are changing, so things have to be adjusted. In fact, I think even some ceremonies as well, you know, I mean, it's basically based on the moon, but, you know, there are things that that have to happen based on the environment and the seeds that are mm-hmm. germinating and coming up and so on. Very, very important stuff. And, you know, we always have to stop and give thanks and greetings to these things. In the arts field, you know, as I've told you in the past, and I've been on this show and we've talked in the past about, you know, many of the projects that are happening in Montreal at the Deon Jojaga here. It is really heartwarming to know that, you know, at one time, you know, we could expect, you know, an Indigenous art show to happen once every 5-7 years. And it was used to be in cycles of, like, there's an interest, you know, like, something happened in society, something, you know, was going on that there was an interest, whether it was a trend or it came into fashion or whatever. But what's interesting is, and I've spoken to other artists about it, Indigenous artists, was like, you know, you always got the feeling that it was going to be contemporary, you know, that the other foot is going to drop and we won't be in style anymore. We won't be called to be, you know, participating in these things. But what I've noticed, I would say in the last 10 years, maybe a little even longer, in Montreal anyhow, I think it really is beginning to change. You know, there are signs that, you know, that it's a permanent thing. You know, that Indigenous artists and opportunities in the arts are blossoming, and, you know, it's a very encouraging sight. I might have told you this story. In 85, we had a big exhibition at the University of Quebec, downtown, and, you know, at that time we thought it was going to be ushering in this great period of interest and, you know, opportunities and art exhibitions and curators, you know, looking for, you know, an authentic voice, an authentic visual style, you know, that kind of like caught on. And unfortunately, those things kind of like slipped away on us. And people, I would say, in my generation coming up, you know, often went to other places, you know, found opportunities in Ontario, in Toronto, in the U.S. and elsewhere, and developed their careers. But like I said, here in Montreal, you know, it's beginning to change. One of the fantastic things that I've kind of had a hand in, I've kind of been involved with, is with the Daphne Art Gallery. That is a beautiful place down on Cosgrain Street, where many of the emerging and established, you know, Montreal creative community is, you know, mm-hmm. that are creating great work and, you know, sharing ideas and so on. They've been in open, I think, at least for 3 years, and they are doing some great programming. You know, they've got some great artists coming in from the rest of Canada, from local people, and they are always open to collaborations and those things. And I'm very pleased that they included me last year in the Nuit Blanche. We did a great printmaking event, and we had a couple hundred people come through. Wow. And people were really pleased. And this year, they are partnering with the Momenta Visual Arts Festival. It's visual arts, but I know they have a strong component of what they call lens-based art, so aka photography, but not exclusively photography. I know that you know, there's some very, very good people in there working with that organization. And I've been, like I said, recruited to be part of that. And we're looking at Aaron Rice is going to be curating it. And we're hoping that my good friend Guy Siwi, Guy, if you're out there, hopefully you're going to agree to be involved and to help do some text. I always like his take on my work. He's written about some of my work in the past. I'm always very surprised sometimes, but also I even learn stuff about myself when someone writes about your work. You know, it's like I intended for people to get that idea, but sometimes you wonder if it translates. And with Guy, I think he's very sensitive to photography, to visual arts in particular, and he's been a great supporter. You know, some of the museums that are doing things too as well. McCord Museum's got, you know, a great one that curator that is there now, Jonathan Laney, and he's doing some wonderful work. He did a great exhibition on the wampum. I don't know if you got to see the wampum exhibition he did last fall. Wonderful. He basically went around the world and collected and had borrowed wampum belts that were used in diplomacy over, wow, you know, the last 400 or 500 years, wow, in the Northeast, and brought them back to North America for the first time in many years. Really quite beautiful and very kind of educational, but cultural, symbolic, political. You know, it just, because they are basically our documents, mm-hmm, that had been used historically over, you know, 1,000 years. People say that indigenous people don't have a writing system. Well, we have wampum belts, mm-hmm, that are precise declarations of what happened, and the beauty of it, like the ancient Greeks, you know, the oral, verbal transmission of knowledge was also very important. You know, that it breathed life into the words, and people's jobs and communities were to learn what, mm-hmm, these treaties had to say, learn what these declarations had to say, and to memorize them and to pass them on through the ages. And we have many examples of that, like the Turo Wampum, the Gaswanta, the Five Nations Confederacy Belt, on and on and on, that these things have been able to do.
Wow. So, I mean, there's a lot for people to look into there, luckily. And so I really would encourage people to look up these various strands. I want to just pick up on a few of them, just to make sure to dig a little bit on some of those points. You mentioned at the beginning K103, which it has this indigenous language broadcast on Wednesdays. So an awesome station. Maybe this is an opening to talk about indigenous language.
Sure.
Just briefly, I think that some people listening won't be aware of the major effort, not just at the radio station, but in many other contexts, I'm sure that you've been connected to, around language revitalization.
Yeah, absolutely. Ganawagi, I mean, surprisingly, you know, we are in the shadow of one of Canada's major metropolises, you know, like 10 miles out of downtown Montreal, and our language has been able to be preserved, you know, and it would say that it's in decline, but I would say that if any language in this area has a fighting chance, it would be our language. We started in our community close to 40 years ago, an immersion program for children, and many of those children have grown up and had children, and they are passing on the language.
Wow.
And we also have an adult immersion program as well that takes in, I believe, about 30 students a year. It's not a major number, but I mean 30 students who are dedicated to learning the language, and it's a two-year commitment. If you, wow, sign up, you register, and you go in, and they select you, you know, you have to be prepared to drop everything for 2 years, and that's usually, it's young adults. Some of them like CEGEP age, and some of them older. When I was, I did it for a year, and it was I went in. I would say in my 40s. Yeah, I was in my 40s. Had I been younger, I suppose maybe I would have had a better chance to become fluent. My daughter, who is 28, 29, she just entered the program. She's finishing up her first year, and she's making amazing progress. And you know, I'm really thrilled. And hopefully, you know, in the next year, and then in the coming years, you know, there will be even more advances. Mm-hmm. It's really quite amazing. The communities founded the radio station. One of the main things was to revitalize the language, to normalize Indigenous languages, our language, on the radio. You know, and I remember I worked at our cultural center for 30 years. When I first started, I worked with many elderly people who told me about when they first heard our language on the radio. Some of them cried. You know, some of them said, like, I never would have in a million years would have imagined that we would be speaking, and we would be able to be telling stories in our language over the year. So, you know, you have to really take your head off to the people who are doing that. Now, you know, the show is on once a week. When I was there, we did once a week, but we also used to, and they still do, three times a year, they do like a half day of programming. And it's really like a telethon, a radiothon. You have people come in, you have elderly people, you have children, you have teachers, you have people who are just, you know, just happen to be in the area, and there's food involved and storytelling, and it's all centered around our language.
Hmm. Well, thanks so much for sharing that. There's also, I mean, if we want to just build on this term language, I think that it seems that in a lot of your photography, you're also developing this visual language and also documenting the communities, the many different Indigenous communities that are present in this city and around. And so I know that you also do photo workshops and printmaking workshops. Just around like the importance of this sort of work to develop a visual language from your vantage point.
Yeah, absolutely. It's, you know, I mean, you think about any metropolitan area and you see, you know, all of the communities. Well, Indigenous people were here before all this happened, you know, our languages, our cultures, the paths that we walked upon, the rivers that we fished in and swam in, you know, and I would say, you know, the through the evolution of the growth of the city, all of these things sometimes kind of like faded away, you know, like people didn't see these things, didn't hear about people doing things. But in a sense, we've always been here. People in Ganawake have always come to Montreal. We've always traded. You know, we have some of the early, you know, the founding of Montreal and markets that were taking place in Old Montreal around the Bon Secours Market, where the museum of what is it called, the Punta Caliera Museum, that there used to be markets, and there were Indians there. There were people from Ganawage, from the north, coming here trading for furs, trading vegetables, buying things. There's an epic program that we found. It's actually in our library, and it's in Old Montreal in the 1870s, 1880s, and it's all of the stores in Old Montreal that catered to Mohawks, and they had it in our language, which is like holy mackerel. They had you know, pages and pages of shoemakers and you know, tool makers and everything like this. So we've always been here, and we're always going to be here. One of the projects that I'm most excited about, and I'm excited a whole bunch of projects, but the annual Orange Shirt Day, or Truth and Reconciliation Day, I've been documenting that event that has occurred in the Montreal, the at least the rallies, the manifestations that have occurred over the years. So this year will be my fourth year, and I plan to continue to document it as long as I have legs and camera to film, or digital SD cards to fill and everything. So I've been documenting that, and I'm really pleased that if anybody's familiar with what's called, well, street and documentary, like heavy metal, there's like 50-100 branches of the family, you know, like what is documentary and what is, you know, cinema verite, and you know, all this kind of, or interviews, or so with photography there are many kind of like branches of the family, but the branch that I kind of identify with and I really enjoy is what's called street photography. So it's basically candid photography in the streets for the most part, and you just kind of like, you go with the flow, you go with the river that is going, and along that journey, you know, you take pictures, you try to find moments that resonate with you and kind of speak to the issue. And whenever I go to these events, you know, I go and I think about, you know, my dad who went to residential school, I think about my grandparents that went to residential school, I think about the pain and the suffering, and we're moving down, you know, all of these, the corridors, the canyons of Montreal, of, you know, steel and concrete and asphalt and so on, and it's kind of like most people are walking, and myself, you know, walking with that heavy feeling, but also a feeling of that, you know, that we survived, that you know, there are many attempts along the road, you know, to make us disappear, to make our languages disappear, to do all these things, but in ways and in methods we resisted, and we're still resisting, we're still speaking out loud, you know, against the government, against, you know, the churches, you know, and informing, you know, the people that, you know, these issues exist, that we're still here. And I'm really pleased that I was able, and I've been able to document them, and I've gotten hundreds of photographs that I enjoy. And the exhibition that's opening at the McCord on the 18th, April 18th, is called Pounding the Pavement, which that is a common expression that street photographers, people go out into the world and try to make art out of the environment that we live in, use. And I'm really pleased that the type of work that I'm going to be exhibiting in this is the work that's from these events. So I mean, it is meaningful to me, and I'm really pleased that it caught the eye of one of the curators that is out there, and I'll be in that thing, and I hope, you know, maybe so 4 years, maybe in another 6 years or so, I will have enough material to create a book. And in the meantime, I'm planning on creating some sort of a zine in the next year or two.
It brings up the question of visibility and presence, and you know, this sort of contradiction around like Canada, in the sense that like there are now stamps, for example, to recall and remember Angélique, you know, okay, the enslaved woman who, sure, burned down old Montreal, and you know, in some ways, like the National Film Board of Canada has like really lionized Alanisa Bombsman's work. But this sort of always historicizes things, and it disconnects them from the present, you know, and I think like artists that are working now, well, of course, Alanisa is still working, but I'm just thinking about like that importance of not, of connecting now and the past, you know, if you see what I'm saying.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. We all have a voice. I mean, even if you're not an artist, you know, if even you work in an office building, I mean, you still carry the story. You still tell your neighbors, you tell your coworkers, you know, the things you experience in life, you know, that some people may not, it may not, it may never even occur to them to think about. Mm. You know, it may never even occur to them to think about residential school doesn't affect me.
Yeah.
You know, they may not talk about loss of land. You know, they may not talk about, you know, continuing, you know, encroachment of, you know, communities into reserve life. You know, it's a very complex story. But as artists, I think, you know, we have to speak out sometimes, and, you know, newspapers, you know, have to tell the story. And, you know, if we leave, you know, something, a record of what is going on, then I think we will have done our job, you know, to have this continue conversation.
Martin, thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome very much there, Stefan. Thank you very much. Nyawagoa onigiwahi.
That was a conversation with Martin Loft, Indigenous photographer and printmaker here on Free City Radio. Thank you so much to Martin for being on the program today. I'm Stefan Christoph. Thanks for tuning in. Free City Radio broadcasts weekly on CKUT 90.3 FM on Wednesdays at 11 a.m. on CGLO 1690 a.m. in Montreal on Wednesdays at 8 a.m. on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on Tuesdays at 8 a.m. on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston on Wednesdays at 11:30 a.m. on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria on Saturdays at 7 a.m., on Met Radio 1280 a.m. in Toronto on Fridays at 5:30 a.m., on CKCU 93.1 FM in Ottawa on Tuesdays at 2 p.m., and on CGSF 90.1 FM in Vancouver on Thursdays at 4:30 p.m. You can find our archives at soundcloud.com/freecityradio. We're also a podcast. Look us up. Just search Free City Radio. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm Stefan Christoph, and we will be back next week.